Hello, this is Gideon Rothstein, and this is a response of the day for the 9th of Nisan. We start with gratitude to the OU and to Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, David Hochhauser, for their help in putting all this together. And today I also start with the confession that we're going to see a tshuva, a response of Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski in Shut Ach Ezer, the first volume, the Evan Ezer section, Simon Chav Vav, number 26, from the 9th of Nisan of Tov Reish Samach of 1900. And we're seeing this. You know, it's about a Kedushin issue. It's about a man who forces Kedushin on a woman and whether or not that counts as Kedushin. We have to worry about it as Kedushin. I have to say that I tend now, as I'm looking more and more at Tshuvot, to shy away from those having to do with marriage issues and divorce issues, just because I feel like I've had so many of them and I'm trying to be as random as I can about it. But if we end up focusing only on these issues, it might just mean that I'm interested in these kinds of issues when they come up in halacha. And therefore, I do try to stay away from them. However, when I was selecting this tshuva the previous day, I think it was for the 8th of Nisan, I was looking at tshuvot, and I saw tshuva of Chaim Ozer, and we rarely get to see and learn from him, so I wanted to pick it up, but it was a tshuva that was so involved in sugyot and assumed so much knowledge that I really wasn't able to communicate it to you. So I felt bad about it. So on the next day, when a Shut Ach Ezer popped up in the list, which doesn't always, I decided to take it. Now, I think it raises important questions, not just about marital issues, questions about how we do and don't evaluate intent in halacha. Because if you think about the question of how do we know what somebody assumes and intends, that's not always simple, and it's especially not always simple because people sometimes change their minds later and then will cast their intentions backwards even if it's not true. So it's particularly important in marriage terms, but it comes up elsewhere as well. But let's just think about it in terms of marriage. Let's suppose man A gives a ring to woman B and says, I want to marry you, right? Harayat Mekudeshetli. And let's suppose, not that we can know this, we'll get some of these issues in the response to them, so I'm not going to give too clear an example, but let's suppose it's unclear what she thought, it's unclear whether she meant to accept the Kiddushin or not, and then 10 minutes later, or a year later, right, and then they separate for whatever reason, they don't see each other. And 3 months later when they talk to her, she says, oh, I never meant to accept Kiddushin. There's two possibilities there. Either it's true, or in retrospect, she realizes it was a mistake. She wishes she had never done it. And she either lies, or maybe even more likely, she lies to herself. And she convinces herself that, no, she never meant to accept the Kiddushin. Now, halachically, that's a problem for us, because if at the moment that it happened, she did mean to accept it, they're married. And the fact that she later regrets it is an important issue, and we'd want to work on it and figure out a way to solve her problem for her, but it doesn't mean she's not married. So that becomes this kind of thing. And it comes up in other places too. So another example that will come up, just to give you a foreshadowing, let's suppose somebody dedicates an animal to be a korban, but it's not known to other people that he did so or she did so, and then they later regret it, and then they say, oh, I never really meant to. So you can't do that, because once it was dedicated, it is now dedicated. Then you might be able to do things to get it undedicated, but first you have to admit that it was dedicated. So that question of how do we in halacha evaluate these things when we don't know and we can't know, because again, the person comes to us later and says, no, I never really meant that, that we are not able to accept, because we don't know that the person is telling the truth, and we especially don't know the person is telling the truth to themselves. So a lot of these situations we have to halakhically evaluate in some kind of an attempt at objectivity. And we'll set up rules about what counts as evidence that we take account of, that we care about, that we notice, and that we include in our analysis of the situation, and what evidence doesn't count, and things like that. So this is a response that he sent to his father. His father was also a rabbi, but he's Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski. He's an important rav. So I just wanted to give you a little more from Rav Chaim Ozer. I looked up online. It turns out that he's got a whole interesting backstory, because he was born in a place called, in Yiddish, they pronounce it, I think, Ivia. And I don't know how they pronounce it in Belarus. It's in Belarus today. And his father was the rav there for 40 years. And his father's father was the rav for 40 years before that. So he's born into this, it's a very small town. It used to be a shtetl. Today it's a 10,000 people live there. So it's a fairly small place. But they were the rabbanim there, and he was well known from his youth to be an extremely important Torah scholar. He apparently had an unbelievable memory, and he eventually became the Rav of Vilna, like the age of 22, because his father-in-law, who had been the Rav of Vilna, passed away, and everybody agreed that he should take his father-in-law's place. So he's a remarkable man. At this point, at this tshuva, he's 37, it's 15 years later, and his father sends him a letter. His father asks his opinion on this thing, and he answers his father with all respect, but he is the Rav of Vilna by this time. I also want to mention, just because I came across it, that Rav Moshe Shatzkis was also in Ivia which apparently was in the district of Vilna. So I don't know. So it seems like, though, it's close enough that it was close enough to Vilna, and then Rav Moshe was born in Vilna and moved there, and then later moved to YU and became known as one of the Bochanim, one of the people who tested people for smicha at YU. So that's a little bit on Rav Chaim Elzer Grudzinski. So Rav Chaim Elzer's father sends to him a question. And here's the question. Here's the case that happened. A man is mishadech his daughter, meaning he gets his daughter engaged to a young man, and they agree that you know, they had an arranged marriage as they did in those days, and everything seems to be fine with it. The boy is from Volozhin. When the prospective bride and groom came to sell her father's house, she might have been a house that the father had, for the dowry. I mean, the father had put this house, I guess he had some real estate holdings, and this house was going to pay off the dowry and be the money that he was going to contribute to the support of the young couple. And so while they're in town for this, meaning they've gone away, she's got to get engaged, she comes back to town, she's engaged, supposed to be marrying this guy, and while she's in this town, a young man from this town walks up to her, is talking to her about whatever he's talking to her about, and he grabs her hand forcefully, meaning he doesn't let it go. He grabs her hand, it seems like she can't pull it away. He puts money in her hand, enough money to qualify for kiddushin money, for betrothal money, and he says to people standing around, "You be my witnesses," and then says, "Hariat mekudeshet li," and he doesn't let her hand go until he's finished saying the formula that would presumably make them marry. Now, when he lets her go, she throws the money away. She throws the money on the ground. Now, some of the witnesses there say, well, she didn't throw it right away. She held it for a little bit, and then she threw it. But everybody agrees that she was very troubled by what was going on. She was very confused, taken aback, and astonished, and wasn't fully in control of herself. And she says, nope, as soon as he let me go, I threw the money away. Now, the guy, this boy, who's trying to break in and marry her under the nose of the person, the man she's engaged to, he says, you know what, in the past we spoke about getting engaged. Now that's important because there is a concept in the Gemara, it won't come up here because Rav Chaim Elzer is just not going to pay attention to it because it's too far away for us to think about it. But the reason why you would claim this is because there is a halacha in the Gemara that if two people had spoken about Kiddushin or were in the process of speaking about Kiddushin, about marriage, then it might be that if you give them money or a present for Kiddushin, it creates that level of connection, that Kiddushin, right? There's two steps to Jewish marriage, is Kiddushin and Nisuin. Kiddushin is the first step, and that creates a bond between them, and then Nisuin means they're fully married. So this, if he gives her something of monetary value, we always today do it with a ring, but money works too, halachically. If you give her something of value, and even if you don't say anything, but if it was already speaking about it, or the topic on the table, that might be good enough for it to qualify as a marriage that then you'd have to worry about and consider them to be have this bond with each other. So he's claiming they've spoken about this many times. I think he also means to say, and therefore she can pretend now she's not interested, but when we spoke about it, she was interested. So I think she was interested, and I think she accepted the money, and I think we were married. And then later on, she realized what she had done. She realized the embarrassment of having gotten married to somebody else, you know, under the nose of the person she was engaged to, and therefore she threw the money away. Now, if his claim was true, let's be clear. If his claim was correct, that at the moment she accepted the money, she thought, oh yeah, I'll get engaged to this guy, good, then we're going to talk about, she can't change it. It's not like she can regret it later. Once she accepts it intentionally, they've got that bond of connection, and that bond of connection needs to be broken either by a gut, by a divorce, or by the death of the husband. So that's where we're standing. The question is, what happened there and what's going on? She'll obviously claim that her money, throwing the money away, was meant to say that she never accepted and she never intended for this marriage to go through. On the issue of their prior discussions, she says, you know, a bunch of years ago when I was younger, and now I don't know what younger is, we don't have the ages of them here, but let's remember that in Europe, around the turn of what we call the 20th century, people got married 14, 15, and 16. So she might be meaning, yeah, when I was 11, and we were playing, you know, as kids do, and he said, you know, we're going to get married one day. I said, yeah, we're going to get married one day. Then I got older, and my father spoke to me, and I realized the issues that come up in marriage, the things that you have to put together, I never meant it now, and I haven't spoken to him about it in years. And I never intended to have any engagement with him in any time that it was relevant. And that's what she's saying. So that's the case. And that's so the father, Chaim Elzer Grudzinski's father, says that in the Shulchan Aruch, we need to notice that in Shulchan Aruch, Siman Mem Bet, it does say that if a man took the hand of a woman, gave her money, or gave her a ring, or whatever it is, and she doesn't throw it away, then she's Mekudeshet to him. There has been a valid Kiddushin, and even though it started off Be'ones, right? Meaning, there are lots of ways that things can happen. Now, this is I think it's probably a delicate topic in our times because there are many women who will say, oh, don't tell me that it can start forcefully and end with consent. because that comes up in other areas of male-female relationships and can be a significant problem, because there will be men who will say, well, if I just force it for long enough, she'll eventually consent and it'll all turn out to be okay. Halachically, I will say, I think that the Gemara and Halacha are aware of the possibility that there are things that start against a woman's will, and she eventually decides she's interested and she likes it. One of those things might be marriage. So, man, you know, let's for example say, if you think of a man who is considered broadly appealing, whoever that might be, or, you know, he's very wealthy, let's say, and very good-looking and whatever, and for whatever reason, he plucks a random woman and says, I've decided I want to be married to that woman. And he walks up to her and he grabs her hand. Now, she doesn't, at the moment, really intend to be married to him. He grabs her hand and he sticks a ring on her finger and he starts saying, Harei Mekudeshet Li. It started by onus. So what are we supposed to, and there are witnesses. He says, you're going to be my witnesses. It starts by onus, she takes the ring, she doesn't do anything. So what does that mean in halacha? I think the answer is in halacha it means if she doesn't object, we assume there's consent. That's the way it works, even though it started forcefully. Now, that's an extreme example only because I wanted to point out that there is a logical reason to say sometimes that things start against the woman's will, and yet she may decide over the course of the action that she wants to. Now, in our case, that would be bad for her, because she's trying to say now she never had consent, and he's saying, and so the Chaim Moshe Grodzinski's father is saying, the fact that it started by onus doesn't prove that there wasn't consent, right? You could have made that the blanket rule. Theoretically, you could say any time an action in halacha starts against the woman's will, we never interpret it as consent. So theoretically, you could say, even if she shouts, yes, 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 I consent. And there are other cases in halacha where that's true, where even if a woman starts saying, no, I'm consenting now, we would still treat it as a non-consensual situation. That comes up. It comes up in like certain kinds of rape cases, whatever it would be. That comes up in halacha. We would not treat it as a consensual case no matter what. But in terms of kiddushin, that's not what we do. So nonetheless, though, there are many achronim who think that in this case we can be makel for various reasons. Chaim Ozer Grodzinski's father wrote to him saying, I want to know your opinion. So this is the opinion now of Chaim Ozer Grodzinski is going to share about why he thinks that this kiddushin really has no validity. So the first is, she threw the money away. The case that I had where it started out non-consensually, we end up saying, no, maybe she consented, but she didn't throw the money away. So the Shulchan Aruch says she didn't throw it away. It sounds like it means she didn't throw it away miyan tok kedei dibur. Immediately, tok kedei dibur is a concept that comes up in many places in halacha. It's sort of, tok kedei dibur is a very brief moment. It's in the time it takes to say to one's teacher, shalom alecha rabbi amori, right? To say those four words, that's tok kedei dibur. Very brief period. But so if she didn't throw it in that very brief period, we say, nope, she must be married. So she must have accepted it, even if she throws it away later. Now, that'll become important for us here, because there was some debate among the witnesses as to whether she threw it away immediately or soon after. But soon after could be beyond the Toch Kedei Dibur time period. So, but the Chaim Ozer Grodzinski points out, I'm not sure why this Toch Kedei Dibur issue comes up at all. It sounds like that's what the Shulchan Aruch is talking about, but why would that be an issue? Because our halacha is, in Kiddushin, Toch Kedei Dibur doesn't mean anything. So for example, let's suppose, to take a simple case, let's suppose a couple is under the chuppah, right? So they've really, clearly everybody agrees they're planning on getting married. And then, for whatever reasons, you could think of lots of scenarios, she's having doubts, and he gives her the ring, and she takes it, and 10 seconds later, she says, you know what? This is crazy. I'm not doing it. So the answer is, halakhically, it doesn't matter that she says that. She can say, I mean, it matters a lot in terms of whether they'll end up getting married to each other, end up completing the marriage with nisuin, or whether they'll just get divorced from this point of kiddushin. That matters, right? Her opinion matters a great deal. But it doesn't matter in terms of nullifying the kiddushin. Once a kiddushin happens, it happens, and the point is, not only is it only after 10 seconds, even after 1 second. If she's at the wedding, he puts the ring on her finger, she takes the ring and then she says, oh, you know what, I changed my mind. You know what, I don't want to. She can't change her mind, it doesn't happen. Right? She'd have to reject the ring. If she rejected the ring and she never accepted, then there wouldn't be a kiddushin. So there's two ways to view that. The Rashbam and Bava Batra seems to think that's a chumrah derabanan, that in fact, even in the case of kiddushin, Toch Kedei Dibur is an open period, and that it doesn't take effect until the Toch Kedei Dibur is over, until that small time period is over, because the Rashbam seems to feel that it's always true on a Torah level, it's always true that actions don't complete, that things don't take full effect until they've been around for a Toch Kedei Dibur. That's the time period within which the Torah is still sort of open. So according to the Rashbam, who says that, and then Rabbanan came along and said, we don't want that. And the reason we don't want that is because we don't want people thinking that her children from the second marriage might be mamzerim. Meaning, let's say it's true that on a Torah level, if she says, within a token day divorce, I changed my mind, I don't want this to happen, and that's valid, that's good, it works, and they're not really married, people might not know that, and they'll see her get married to somebody else without any kind of a get or a divorce from the first husband, and they'll say, oh, those children are mamzerim. And because of that, the Rashbam seems to have held that we're not going to hold. We're going to do Rabban and tell her that even if she changes her mind to the divorce, she needs a get, and that will have impact on her life because she won't be married to a Kohen. Now, if it's only the Rabbanan issue of that Ketoka Dibur thing, then you might say that if she was quiet in the Ketoka Dibur period, maybe we wouldn't say that she needs to get me the Rabbanan, since it's, after all, only the Rabbanan, it's a Chumra the Rabbanan. If she said, yes, I accept, then we would have that Chumra the Rabbanan, that even if she changed her mind and says no. But let's say she was quiet, she didn't tell anything to us, and then after the Ketoka Dibur says, you know what, I never meant to accept it, or I changed my mind within Ketoka Dibur, maybe since she was quiet, there was never a full completion of it, maybe you would accept it. But if she only speaks up, but after Kedei Dibur, if that's when she changes her mind, she says, oh, you know, I just realized I don't want to do it. So that's a suffix of Torah. So she was quiet until then, and then she says afterwards, I'm now, you know, I never it. That would be a Torah problem. That would be a biblical issue. That would be according to the Rashbam. But there are many Rishonim who hold that Kedei Dibur is Kedushin even min haTorah, that once she accepts it and doesn't reject it, that's a Kiddushin, and she doesn't have any time to change her mind. There is no such thing as changing. There's no open period afterwards, as there is in other areas of halakha, but there's no period after here, such that, according to these Rishonim, let's suppose, not she didn't necessarily say anything about this, or she changed her mind, but let's suppose she was so clear that she thinks she rejected the marriage, that she took Kiddushin from somebody else, meaning she planned to marry somebody else, we wouldn't even say she needs a get lechumra from that second guy, because we say that's not a marriage. Why is it not a marriage? Because she's a married woman already. And when married women accept Kiddushin from other men, it has no effect in halakha whatsoever. So if that's true, then there's no nafkamina, there's no difference between Tokhet Edibur within that four-word time period and afterwards. And if so, why would the Shulchan Aruch, all of a sudden, the case of where the man grabbed her hand and forced money or a present on her, the Shulchan Aruch seemed to say that if she didn't say throw the money away within a Ketoka Dibur, she's got a problem. Why is the Shulchan Aruch bringing up that issue of Ketoka Dibur? Ketoka Dibur regarding marriage seems to be only a very minority opinion of the Rashbam. So Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski brings in an idea that he said, that he saw in She'elot V'Tshuvot V'Shav HaKohen, which is a book of response by Rav Rafael ben Yekutiel Ziskin HaKohen Katz, also known as Rafael Hamburger, who was a Rav of Hamburg in Germany he lived from 1722 to 1803, according to the Hebrew Wikipedia, and he was the Rav of Hamburg for many, many years. I think he's well known as the Rav of Hamburg, and that's true. I actually know a good story about him. I'll tell it in extreme brevity, so if it doesn't sound like a good story, it's because I'm telling it very briefly, because I don't want to take too much time for that. But supposedly on the first day of his rabbinate, he gets a message, a woman, and in those days, women very often, the unprotected of society, and this was a widow, and she comes, she has a claim against the richest man in town, who's clearly the most important and influential man in town, and she wants to call into a Din Torah to a Torah judgment. So Rafael Hamburger sends to the guy to come for a Din Torah, and he says, you have to come. There's a court case. This woman is sued. You have to come to a Din Torah. And there's this whole back and forth where the rich man in town doesn't come, and he threatens the Rav, and he says, you know, you're going to lose your job, and what are you doing, and pack your bags, and you're crazy. And Rafael, this rabbi, Rafael Katz, Rafael, known as Rafael Hamburger, sticks to his guns and insists that the rich man has to come, and he says, maybe I'll be fired after this, but I'm right now the Rav, and you got to come, and whatever. And when they finally come, it turned out it was a test. They were just trying to make sure that the rabbi would be independent enough to know that he had to stand up for those who might be oppressed and those who might have problems, and that was part of his job. And they didn't want somebody who was going to just yield to the rich people of town. It's a remarkable story in a lot of ways. Probably that's why it sticks with me. It's remarkable that the rabbi's actions are remarkable, and this very rich homeowner's very rich influential man's actions are remarkable, because unfortunately sometimes people in that position will want that kind of influence, and they won't want the rabbi to be too independent. In any case, this Rafael Hamburger had a book of Tshuvot called V'Shav HaKohen, and he was discussing a completely different topic. He was discussing the question of Hekdesh. Now, Hekdesh is when we want to donate something. A person wants to donate something to the Beit HaMikdash to sanctified purposes. And there too, there's this idea that once I declare something hektesh, there is no grace period. It's not like if I say, you know what, I want this car to go to the Beit HaMikdash, and then I say to myself, that's crazy, what are you doing? It's a car, it's so much money. And so within its own, within the time of those rabbis, say, no, that's crazy, well, I didn't mean it, or I don't want it to be true. Doesn't matter. Hey, that's halacha. That's a very similar halacha by hektesh. Once it takes effect, you can't. Once you declare it, you can't take it back. It doesn't have an open period where it's not fully in effect yet. Rafal Katz suggested that in the case of hektesh, though, there is a situation where maybe you could, because it happens to be the halacha is that when it comes to things like donating to hektesh, our thoughts can also qualify. That comes from a whole limud that's not mentioned here in the tshuva of the Nediv Leim, that if we in our thoughts plan to give something to hektesh, it takes effect, and it's something that nobody can check you on it, because nobody knows what's in your head other than HaKadosh Baruch Hu, other than Hashem, but it's something that you need to keep in mind, that if you have thoughts to donate something, then it's donated. So Rafal Katz said, okay, fine. But when we say, there's a principle in the Gemara of Amira leGavoa kemesira leHedyon, that when you declare something that you're going to give it to Hekdesh, that's like if you were talking to a friend, you actually gave the friend something. So let's say, you know, let's say I give a friend, you know, a friend that I agree, he's going to buy some apples for me, and I give him 10 apples. As soon as I give him those apples, they're his. And if I say, you know what, I changed my mind, I don't want the sale to go forward, I can't do that. I can convince him to give them back to me. I can buy them back from him. There's all sorts of options that's what could happen, but I can't nullify the sale. The sale occurred, right? That's because there was a kinyan. Once there's an acquisition, the sale occurred. The halacha is, the Gemara says, and we paskin that when it comes to the Beit HaMikdash, when it comes to giving things to Hekdesh, so there, Amira works as well. If I say I'm giving it, it's already given. So the Rafal Katz says, it's only the Amira, it's only the declaration that's kimisirat alahadyot, that's fully an acquisition, like giving it to, giving it to a regular person, but not thoughts. So he suggested in Vishav HaKohen, I'm sorry, it's probably Vishav HaKohen, he suggested that if I think to myself I'm going to give it, and then Toch Kedei Dibur I change my mind, maybe that does work, because I only thought it, and thinking it is different. So if that would be true, perhaps we could say, says Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski, that if she didn't do anything, as in this case, her hand was being held, and she didn't say yes, she didn't nod her head, she didn't do anything, then maybe you might think to yourself that even if she were to later admit, you know what, at the moment he did it, I thought, oh yes, I remember we used to play together, we loved each other, oh yes, but then within a Toch Kedei Dibur, in her head, all is going on in her head now, within a Toch Kedei Dibur, within the very brief period of those four words, the time it would take to say four such short words, she thinks, oh, that's crazy, no, 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 and she changes her mind. Maybe you could apply that same idea. You could say that since it was all in her head, even though it's true that she can agree in her head, if she agrees in her head and just stays in her agreement, that creates a valid condition, because all we need is her consent, and her consent can be given implicitly, not explicitly, but maybe in the case of implicit consent, just like Rafal Katz suggested about things being donated to the Hekdesh, maybe in case of implicit consent, there's a time period in which she can change her mind as well and go back. Problem is that Rav Chaim Ozer Grudzinski doesn't accept this idea of the Vishava Kohen. He says there are those who disagree with it. There's a Mordechai, which is a Rishon, that seems to go against it. There's a Rav Haigon that also seems to go against it. And I skipped a little bit here because he goes on a little bit about it. We don't have so much time. And then he points out, and I have in another place where I wrote where I think the exact opposite might be true. That maybe it's only, that the only possibility of Toch Kedei Dibur, of having that grace period in which you can change your mind, maybe that only applies where speaking is an issue, where you've spoken, because it could be that when the Torah tells you that even thoughts can work, what it's telling you is that those thoughts are immediately applied and there is no Toch Kedei Dibur. And his suggestion is that the whole idea of a Toch Kedei Dibur literally means within the time of speech. So it might be telling you that speech is somewhat indeterminate, so that speech can be changed, but maybe thoughts are different. That's what Chaim Ozer Grudzinski had suggested in another place. And that reminds us, I think this is an important issue, it's not our topic today, but it reminds us that when it comes to Torah, there are very important Torah scholars who know a lot of Torah, who think about things very carefully and very well, and come to very different perspectives. And therefore, you have to figure out what that means and how that works. So Chaim Ozer Grudzinski is saying, it's a nice idea of the Shav HaKohen, so maybe it could have applied here, except that I don't think it's true. I don't think it works. I don't think it's the way to view it. So that's a whole topic of its own. And he thinks that that's why the Rambam writes, if after somebody decided to make something hektesh, to denote something to the Beit HaMikdash, and articulate it, said it out loud, so then the hektesh takes effect by virtue of his thinking about it. So therefore, the fact that he speaks and then changes his mind as he speaks won't make any difference because it already took effect when he thought about it. That's what the Reb Chaim Elazar Grudzinski is understanding the Rambam to mean. Whereas he points out that when the Rambam is talking about Tzemura, in the case of Tzemura, Machshava, thoughts don't work. Thoughts work by donating things to Hekdesh. But Tzemura is where I'm going to try, where I think to myself, I'm going to substitute one thing for the something that I already donated to Hekdesh. It's not a good idea because it ended up both things being owned by Hekdesh. But there is no idea of Machshava. If I just think it in my head, it doesn't take effect. So there, the Rambam just says that there is no such thing as Chazara Tokhi Dibor, but he doesn't have to say it has to do with thinking or anything like that. He just tells you that's the halacha. Now all this sort of assumed that Tokhi Dibor was a grace period in which you could change your mind. But Rav Chaim Grudzinski says he thinks that's not even true. He thinks that that's a misreading of it, and he points out the Chacham Tzvi said so as well. The Tokhi Dibor isn't a question of, yes, you have an open time to change your mind. It's that if somebody says in the Tokhi Dibor that it's different, it's that we think that, at least when it comes to Kiddushin, they never intended to accept the Kiddushin. And when it comes to an umdinat like that, a reconstructing of somebody's perspective, so it can't be that they said something that completely changed their mind. It's that they would say, we would assume that they meant, what they mean is they misspoke, or that they never intended to, right? So that's different than you have a time to change your mind. It's that, it is. So her throwing it away, Tokhi Dibor, is not a question of she changed her mind. It's a question of that reveals that she never intended to accept it. And then he points out that the Nesivos HaMishpat, and has a book called Kehilas Yaakov, he says he thinks that when she throws the money back in his face, that could be even after Kedei Dibor. It couldn't be a year later, but it could be after Kedei Dibor. You need that narrow time period because he thinks that too proves that she never intended it, right? He gives her the money. You know, what if somebody says to you, what if she's stewing about it? She's furious that he thought he could force her into this. And 30 seconds later, she throws the money in his face. So, let's assume for a second that we absolutely know that's what happened. So the Nesivos HaMishpat says there was never any consent there. There was never any acceptance there. The fact that she didn't do the action of throwing it in his face until 30 seconds, that doesn't show anything. And the fact that she eventually throws it in his face, that he held, now he's a minority opinion, but he held that's good enough to qualify as denying there was ever a Kiddushin. So those who disagree with the Nesivos HaMishpat say, no, you can't let things linger that long. And in Halacha, if they linger that long, we have to assume there was a consent there. And the Chatam Sofer thinks that as well. But he thinks that the only time that we can say later events prove what the context of the early events when happened sort of right away, but in our situation where he held her hand and then as soon as he stopped holding her hand, maybe not Tokhi Dibor, but very soon after he stopped holding her, but down by force basically, she threw it back at him. So that he thinks lots of people would agree to that that we can say we can say that it becomes very clear that she never intended to accept the Kiddushin, and we can use that as proof of that, and therefore to say that she's not married to him, and it's sort of like she's Tzavach Meikara, that Rav Chaim Elazar Grudzinski points out. Let's suppose that as this boy approached, she had just said to whoever's standing around, oh, he's coming and he thinks we were engaged once and that's not true, or I don't want it to be true and I don't know what he's going to do, but I'm not interested in getting married to him. He walks up to her, he grabs her hand, he puts the money in her hand, and he lets the money go. 20 seconds later, she throws the money down on the ground, and she says, I'm not married to you. So Chaim Elazar says, would anybody think that she is? Do we need her to be yelling the entire time? But there's no such halachic requirement. Once she made clear that she's not interested, so she's not interested. So the only question is, let's say she was quiet, and then she said she wasn't interested. So that's where we have some question, but he thinks that her throwing the money in his face demonstrates that she was also never interested in the way they were saying. There's also a machloket, and this comes up in situations like, let's say he throws the money onto her person, you know, against her will. She didn't even realize it was coming in. He throws it, it sticks onto her in some way. So there, we don't think that there's any validity to it, unless they had been talking about Kiddushin issues, and then he throws it onto her, and she doesn't, and in a way that she could easily have thrown it back, and she doesn't. So then there are more things we have to hold that she changed her mind and accepted. But the Chokek, a commentary there, says he doesn't understand. The Rambam seems to be saying both ways. If it's against your will, it doesn't count. Like he said, when you just throw it onto her and it's just in her, let's see, throws it into her dress and she's like reach in and pull it out right away and throw it down in his face. And then other times he says, but if she doesn't throw it out, then it is consent. So the Chokek thinks that maybe it's that if her being quiet, if it was by force, doesn't mean anything. That's what the Rambam wanted. But Shmuel, there's another commentator there, he thinks it might have to depend on whether he said to her beforehand, we're talking about Kiddushin, and she hadn't immediately protested it before the coercion came in. So basically, sum total from all these discussions, Chaim Moshe Grotzky is saying the fact that he forced her into it, and she never gave any sign of consent, and she eventually, whether it was exactly the Tokat they did or not, but she eventually showed that she didn't want it, all of that is good enough for us to say that she never consented, there's never a marriage here, and therefore there's never a problem. He throws in also the fact that he's holding her by force, what it seemed to imply, that if he let her hand go, she would have withdrawn it, and that too helps us understand that she never meant to be participating in this kiddushin. So sum total, Chanazel agrees with his father and other people of the time who said this doesn't count as a marriage. The fundamental question is what counts as demonstration of consent in halacha. There's also a question about if somebody consents to something, are there times and ways that one can get out of it? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. There the Tokhi de Dibur issue comes into play. And if there's a question of you might be able to change your mind within Tokhi de Dibur, which Chanazel agrees doesn't think it is, he thinks it's a question of revealing what your thoughts are. So then how does that come into play if she hasn't said anything and then she does the action and then she says that it was what it's supposed to mean? So in these cases where the boy or the man had coerced her to begin with, we think there's plenty of room to say that she never demonstrated any consent, especially by virtue of the fact that she threw the money back at him and said, no, I never intend to get married. So that is a tshuva of responsible of Chaim Moshe Grudzinski for the 9th of Nisan about what happens when somebody tries to coerce kedushin on a woman, and the answer is fundamentally, if she shows in some meaningful, reasonable kind of way that she never intended to accept it, we will believe her and she will not be married to that man in any way whatsoever. Have a great day.